All right, welcome to another episode of Let There Be Talk. Today is April 11th. Is it April? Yes, it is. Sorry, I have just no clue ever what the date is, but it is April 11th. I know it is a Monday, so that means a new episode of Let There Be Talk. Brought to you by my podcast network, CactusRadioNetwork.com. Get all of my podcast on the website absolutely free. You can hear Dark Fonzie, At Home with Byron Katie, The Grail, and Let There Be Talk at CactusRadioNetwork.com. Okay, it's episode 641, and it is another drummer today, but not just any drummer. This man is part of a two-piece onslaught known as Royal Blood. I saw this band back in, I think, 17-ish or 18, opening for Queens of the Stone Age at the Los Angeles Forum, and it fucking blew my mind. Just rocking. Bass and drums. That's it. Bass and drums up there, smashing it. My guest today is Ben Thatcher. He is the drummer in this two-piece masterpiece. And it was great to sit down and talk to him, man. What a story. Played in a Christian band at church, like at 10 years old. Back there playing every week for like 300 people in his church. His brother was in a Christian rock band. Then he gets turned on to a little Blood Sugar Sex Magic. Falls in love with that record. Way into Chad Smith. Loves John Theodore. Loved the Mars Volta. Then gets into a little Slipknot and all of that stuff. Metallica. And next thing you know, he's back there on the kit smashing it out. Playing arenas right now as we speak. Sold out the O2 Arena. Two guys selling out the O2 Arena. 30,000 people getting ready to do a U.S. tour coming over here, and I'm looking forward to seeing them. I cannot wait. I want to see them. I've only seen them once. Hopefully, I won't be on the road. I mean, hopefully, I am on the road. I do want to see them, but I want to fucking work. I love their records, man. The new one from 21 that a lot of people probably didn't even know came out because of a little thing called COVID, Typhoons. This record's smoking. Check it out. Of course, in 17, How Did We Get So Dark? And their debut, Royal Blood, back in 14. A lot of people go cuckoo for this band. And if you have not heard them, wow, I would be surprised. But if you haven't, you've got a new favorite band. I can't thank you enough for tuning in. I can't thank you enough for supporting Let There Be Talk and my Patreon. It means the world to me. Patreon.com/Dean Del Rey. I'm going to do a new bonus episode this week and a Zoom Fest. I couldn't get one in over the weekend because I was in Cabo San Lucas doing comedy, and they've got shit Wi-Fi down there, which is kind of a blessing and a curse. A blessing meaning like, okay, get my face out of the computer and look at this goddamn incredible landscape of the desert and ocean. You got the Sea of Cortez on one side, the Pacific on the other side. It all comes down to a tip down there, and it's just beautiful. I fell in love with Cabo San Lucas back in around 95, 6-ish, around there. I don't know, maybe a little early. Earlier than that, I've loved it ever since. Old days, I was going there back, you know, Sammy built that Cabo Wabo when no one knew what Cabo San Lucas was. It was just a spot where cruise ships came in and marlin fishermen guys went. And that was it. First time I went there, it was all dirt roads. The airport was outdoor. It was an outdoor airport. You just flew in. It looked like something that, you know, one of those kind of makeshift drug drop-off airports. You flew in, you got out of the plane, you were just on the tarmac, and it was hot as shit, and you were in the desert, and then you got into some bad old van with no shocks and drove on a dirt road for about 40 minutes, and then you rolled into this dirt town that had a Dairy Queen and a pharmacy, one pharmacy where all the, you know, the cruise ship people come in and get their Vicodin and their Viagra. And then the Cabo Wabo, it was just, I was like, what is this? This is weird. Like, how did Sammy find this? And then I understood exactly what he saw in the place, and I've loved it ever since. I do love The Other Side a little more as I get older. As I'm an old man, I don't like that noise. I don't like that boom, 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 Squid Row, dance clubs. I like to be on the other side. Toto Santos, all out there, Rancho Pescadero. Oh, that beautiful Pacific side, even though it's got a lot of wind on that side, and I hate the wind, but, you know, it's a spot I could see myself, if I didn't do comedy, somehow trying to live out there with a KTM electric dirt bike, just eating fish tacos, checking out tortoises walking around. I love that shit, man. I love it. I love the desert. Where, especially when you have the ocean right there, that's the, to me, that's it. You got full cactus, crazy. It's like Joshua Tree, but with an ocean. I love that. It's fucking, man, it's perfect. Anyway, great weekend. Chase Bernstein featured. She did a great job. Check her out on Instagram. And thank you to anybody that is new listening to the podcast that might have seen us out there. Got some great shows coming up. I will be shooting something for Netflix. 12 and a half years in. Pounding on the fucking doors. Doing the spots. Doing the work. And not really paying attention to it. Yeah, getting bummed once in a while. But reminding myself it's all about doing comedy. As the great Jerry Seinfeld once said, the reward is doing comedy. That's the reward. And I'll never forget it. I always keep that in my mind. And I love that quote from him. It's, I don't know, I might be misquoting him, but it was something like somebody said, like, you know, people forget, you know, they go, oh, I got to get famous. I got to fucking do it. Now the reward is being able to get on stage every night and tell jokes. And that really is the truth. But May 4th, I've been asked to do Bill Burr and Friends from my great friend, Mr. Bill Burr. He has once again come through with just something incredible for me. And hey, this guy's just gold in the comedy community. I could sit here for hours and tell you how many people he's helped and opened the doors for, and you don't even know. Just over and over and over. He's not one of those guys like, yep, looks like I helped five more people. He doesn't do that. He just silently rolls around, find out who's working their ass off, and you know, helps them out somehow. And holy smokes, has he helped me out. But you got to do the work. He's not just going to, you know, oh, Dean's a friend of mine, so I'm just going to get him something on Netflix. That's not how it works. That's not how it works, man. You gotta be grinding. You gotta be funny. You gotta be doing the work. And May 4th at the Palladium, two shows. Gonna be insane. That's where Richard Pryor did the legendary Live on the Sunset Strip. It's gonna be me, Jimmy Carr, Jessica Curson, Joe Bartnick. Who else is on this? Fuck, I don't have the list in front of me. Someone else. Oh, Ian Edwards and a couple other people. Anyway, I can't wait. It's nerve-wracking. I'm not nervous. I just want to be fucking good. I just want it to be good. I always try to do the best that I can. I try to fucking go all out. And I'm looking forward to that. Got some friends, some Patreoners coming out to see it. I can't wait for that. Patreon.com/DeanDelRay. Once again, also great merchandise on my website. We have the Gertie hoodie and sweatshirt. We have the Grail shirt. We have some Dean Del Rey Perry Shawl shirts. And the last of the Dark Fonzie collector item shirts. So get in on that stuff. DeanDelRay.com, tour dates and merch. And don't forget to catch me with Bill Burr in Sacramento in May, and also Oakland Coliseum. Got a brand new Oakland scarf. Going to be good times. Looking forward to seeing my man, Club Soda Kenny, will be out there. All right. I guess that's it. Is that it? By the way, Royal Blood has a brand new single out, Honey Brands, and they're about to start their U.S.-Canadian tour. A little combination, so looking forward to seeing that. I can't thank you guys enough. Like I said before, let's get into it. We've got another drummer here, Ben Thatcher of Royal Blood. Candles are lit. How are you, bud?
Yeah, not bad, man. Not bad. Glad to be back on the road and playing shows, getting behind the drums. It's great.
Yeah. You know, I first saw you guys, a buddy of mine, and I went and saw you guys at the LA Forum with Queens of the Stone Age. And, and you guys crushed it, man. That was the only time I've seen you so far, because when you come through town, I'm usually on the road. But what a great night that was, huh? The Forum?
Yeah, man. That was a super special show. We had a lot of fun. Touring with those guys was an absolute blast as well.
Oh, yeah. I love those guys. John Theodore, what a killer, right?
Man, he's brilliant. He's the best drummer in the world, John Theodore.
And his vibe is cool, you know?
Oh, yeah. He's the coolest dude out there, man.
I love Josh. Josh is a god to me. He is the high watermark of art, you know?
Yeah, he's a very, very great man.
Now, I was digging into it, and I was looking. It was funny because that's about the time I get turned on to you guys on the How Did We Get So Dark record. It's funny because I've been following you ever since, but pretty much I was looking at your career. You guys have got to do all of the dream gigs. Speaking of the Fillmore, you know, you did like Glastonbury. You did Reading, you've done Coachella, just all the great, great festivals, man. That's incredible, right? When you're a kid growing up thinking about like, oh, God, I might play the Reading Festival one day, like Metallica, you know?
Yeah, man, it's something that we never thought we'd get to do. And it's something that still is unbelievable to think that we've done it. And we take each gig as it comes. And so all of them kind of merge into one almost, because we play our last show like it's our last show, you know? And so those massive gigs, although there's obviously a big title on them, being Reading Festival or Glastonbury or whatever, you know, they're still just as important to us as the smaller shows. And because, you know, we put all into every show that we do.
Now, starting out on drums, who was it for you when you were growing up? Because you obviously grew up in a different era than me. I'm 56. Of course, it's Zeppelin if you're a drummer, and it's Rush, you know, and that kind of stuff. But you're not really one of those type of bands. So what was it for you? Was it just more dance hall grooves and stuff like that, like Emotional Rescue, Stones, Four on the Floor stuff?
To be honest with you, I grew up on Chad Smith.
Oh, great.
He was my go-to, and Dave Grohl, and then obviously Taylor Hawkins, but John Theodore as well, man. He, you know, when I heard the first Mars Volta record, the drumming on that is you can't replicate that, man. It's unbelievable. And so, but I guess Chad from a really young age, I had one of his videos, like a VCR of him doing something I can't remember what it's called now. I can't remember, but he was like in some studio in LA playing Blood Sugar Sex Magik. And yeah, it just blew my mind. And it was when like, I saw that, I just wanted to learn that record.
And what do you do? Do you go out and get a drum kit right away, or do you play anything before the drums?
Now, that time I had a drum kit. I had a drum kit from the age of six.
Wow.
It was all I wanted to do. And even before that, I was on like pots and pans and yeah, always tapping away.
Were you going out and seeing live music young, or was this, you know, cause some people live in areas where there wasn't a lot of concerts, but were you able to go see like the Chili's and stuff like that?
When I was a little bit older, I was, but I grew up really, I cut my teeth playing at church. And that was the gig that I would do every week, in front of like 300 people from the age of 10. And that's how I kind of got drumming on a regular basis. And I guess that's how I got into performing in front of people and being comfortable behind the drums.
Yeah. Oh, church band. How many pieces was that? Like a big old band or?
It changed every week. It was it was like a small community church. So it wasn't that big, but it was like Christian rock, we would call it, I guess now. But
wow. And you grew up in obviously a religious family. Were they kind of one of those families that were anti-rock or were they cool with it?
My parents weren't musical at all. So my brothers were, and they were in a Christian rock band actually called Delirious.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, who got to like tour with Bon Jovi and Bryan Adams, and it was kind of fine. I didn't really have a very good musical education because I was just surrounded by religious rock, I guess. And then I kind of was into pop music growing up. Like I remember one of my first albums was Britney Spears' first record, but it was stuff that I could drum along to, you know. I love drumming along to that kind of music. Just find it fun. And then I got into bands during my early teens, I guess.
Were you heavily into that like Mach 2 of the Brit wave of like Oasis and the Verve and all that? Because that stuff just knocks me out.
Yeah, it was kind of, I kind of grew up at the end of that. So that was going on when I was quite young, the whole Britpop thing. But I remember it. I remember Be Here Now coming out, the Oasis album, and remember that I used to play that all the time. But yeah, I wasn't so into that genre. I think I was more into pop music at that time, and then I got into real heavy rock straight from that.
And who do you start listening to once you get into heavy rock, other than the Chili's and the Mars Volta and stuff? Are you listening to any metal?
Yeah, Metallica. Motorhead, Guns N' Roses. It's all American music, really, I listen to. And then Foo Fighters, Nirvana, even like Korn and Slipknot and all the new... I was a new metal kid, really. I was in that wave with Papa Roach and all of those guys and bands. So yeah, that was my teens. That's how I listened to music then.
So when you and Mike decide to start Royal Blood, obviously it's a two-piece band, and bass and drums, there's quite a bit of that was going on, you know, from obviously the Kills and White Stripes and all of that was going on. Was it a conscious decision, let's just be two-piece because it's hip, or was it hard to find band members? Because when I was starting a band, it was hard to find dudes, and when you did, you just kind of settled for a guy because there wasn't another guy that wanted to play bass or something, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think the chemistry between Mike and I was quite obvious. When we got together in a room, there was an energy and a sound behind what we played right from the start. And it was, I mean, I'm a massive fan of two-piece bands. I love, you know, White Stripes, Death From Above, but it felt different from that, and it felt like our own little thing that we were doing. But it obviously made things easier not having so many people in our band, because the touring logistics was great and band practices were easy, and we got to tour around in, you know, just us two in a van kind of thing, so that was cool. But it was more to do with the sound that we could create, and when we did that, the reaction we were getting from people.
Yeah, the early on gigs, I was reading that you guys had to play like open mics and stuff. I'm a comedian. I did open mics. I know how brutal that is. Were you rolling in? Was it just a plethora of different stuff, like a comedian, a poet, a band, an acoustic folk singer, that kind of stuff?
It was mainly like acoustic singers, like singer-songwriters. And then we turned up with, it was our mate, Chris, who put on the acoustic night, the open mic night, and we were just like, we can't get any gigs, can we come and play? He's like, yeah, sure, man. And we're like, brought in a drum kit, a load of amps, and the reaction that we would get, because everyone's expecting this nice chilled acoustic singer-songwriter to come on or whatever, and then we come on and play, and we had the songs at that time as well. We had to figure it out. We had like some of the tunes from the first record that, you know, we were just rocking out when we turned up.
And what would he let you play, like three songs or something?
Yeah, we only had three songs, so yeah.
At what point, how do you guys start to get some heat? You know, when I played music, of course, you do a bunch of demos and you get some guy that shops them around and stuff. But were you just kind of getting a little buzz in the town you were in or playing, or and record company people were coming around, or were you sending tapes? What was going on?
We played very few gigs. We couldn't like really get gigs. And then we used SoundCloud, I think it was, to put up a song. And then a guy from Warner Chappell Publishing, he's not there anymore, but his name is Phil Christie, heard it and was like, take it down from SoundCloud. It was like, we need to talk.
Wow.
And yeah, and he's a lifelong friend, man. He's he became the president of Warner Records here in the UK, and we still work with him today. So it's a, yeah, it's been an incredible journey with him. But he kind of found us and took us through the music industry and the ins and outs, and yeah, he taught us a lot.
Man, that's amazing to think about, like the platforms that bands have these days. Of course, you know, SoundCloud, there's millions and millions of people on there, but the reachability of it with a quote unquote A&R guy now, you know, back in the day, an A&R guy had to hear about a band, or he would be combing nightclubs around LA. Ooh, I saw this band opening last night. And then, you know, but now they can just kind of check out Bandcamp or SoundCloud all day.
They can just sit in their pants, can't they? And just listen to music, and it's actually a lot quicker for them, isn't it? But saying that, it will take a lot longer because there's so much shit out there as well, and so much to plow through. Because anyone can make a record now in their bedroom. I mean, I've made 12 under different names, still trying to get signed, man.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's so funny, man, because to think about. I mean, I get submissions of bands every day, you know, probably 20 a day. Hey, check us out. And whoo, man, it's rough out there a lot of the times. But once in a while, you do get a gem and it's like, whoa, you know, this is pretty damn good. But then once you like the tune, to me, at the end of the day, you got to be able to play live, because, you know, a good song is great and it's going to get some butts in the room. But then once you're in there, if you don't have it, you don't have it. And the thing was, you guys killed live. How long did it take to really start to gel as a live act? Because you're, like you said, you don't have a lot of gigs. And then once it starts happening, you're starting to play some pretty high profile gigs. Was that nerve wracking? And were you just learning it as you came along, or did it come, quite easy?
Yeah, man. We're a live band first, really, before anything.
But not with a lot of gigs under your belt, though, right? You know,
well, not with Royal Blood, but we have been in many bands together, and we were like, so it was kind of the opposite to us. It was more like, how are we going to make our record sound like us live? And how, because we feel like our live performance has so much energy, and you kind of have to be there to experience it, that it was hard to get that on record. And also we're perfectionists as well. And so to have that fantasy of making your music come out of the speakers the way it comes out live is really, really difficult. And you don't want to almost think too much about it, because rock and roll is about being in the moment and almost having it in your first take, you know, and having that. And it, because if you're going on and on and on trying to record and trying to replicate something, it loses its value and it loses its energy and its toughness. And for instance, our Figure It Out is arguably our best song. And the most popular, and that song was, we like when we were started playing that live, Mike didn't have any lyrics. That's where Figure It Out came from, because he would just be like, da, 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 I'll just figure it out, like. and so that was the happy-go-lucky like mentality of the band, really. It was like, well, you know, we'll figure this out, let's just play. And we recorded that song and a couple of others before we, like, it was when the band first started. It was in between Christmas and New Year's, because that was the cheapest time to get a studio. And it was just our mate Tom recording us. And we recorded four songs, I think, and Figure It Out being one of them. And when we got signed and we're putting the album together, we're like, well, this song's obviously going to go on, but, like, do we re-record it? And we tried re-recording some of them, and we're like, this is, like, we've lost our minds here, because when we did it back then, and kind of the cheapness and the speed of it all made it so cool that you couldn't go back and do that again. And it was just us in that moment, in that time. And I think we've learned from that, like, going on. Even this latest record, it's quite a move from and a departure from our first record, but it's us captured at that time. And it's what we wanted to do, and where we, you know, we're trying to do something a little bit different. And it's just, yeah, just screenshots almost of who we are and what we want to do.
Yeah, it's funny. I had someone on recently, and they were talking about how they don't like to demo because you're never going to match that. And you're always going to be putting it up against the demo. So in this day and age also, I think lo-fi or indie or any type of recordings fly as long as it's not a complete piece of shit. But back in the day, there was that pressure. You would kind of, you know, demo on a 4-track Fostex in your room, and then you go to the 24-track studio with the, you know, $3,000 day rate, and you're under the pressure and you're trying to get it, and the performance isn't there. And, you know, it's just a nightmare, man. But these days, you can demo at your house. It's not demoing with, you know, Pro Tools and shit. This is the record.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's, we've kind of learned that along the way, because back when we first started, we didn't have the facility to do those demos. And also being a live band, we don't know how to record drums, like, to a studio level, you know, how the old guys did it, basically.
Yeah.
And those mic techniques and the compressors, you know, we don't have that, where a lot of people who record music now don't use live drums. You know, there's so much software now you can get that can replicate it, but you're really just playing it in, or playing it in on an electric kit or something. So that is something that we really hold on to with our recordings. That it's all live drums, and we need people who know how to record that well to be involved in our recordings.
Yeah, live drums is where it's at. I don't care what anybody says. I even like, you know, no click. I like a little movement in there, you know?
Absolutely.
It's not techno. Look, Kraftwerk is fantastic, but when it comes to rock and roll, I like some move, you know?
Absolutely. Well, our recordings, we've done a lot to click, which is fine, because it's like, I actually quite enjoy playing to that, but live, we don't ever use any click. There's none of that. There's no tracks going on for us. But within the latest record has a lot of production and some, like, strings and stuff. So it's been an interesting and a real development on our playing to include those bits in and do those bits without using track and stuff, which has become quite fun.
Now, you guys have the unfortunate of a lot of bands like Pearl Jam and some other records that I really liked in 20 that came out during COVID. And I refuse to let these records, you know, die because of what happened, you know, and Typhoons is fantastic. And thing is, it's a record that needs to be heard by people, because, you know, all these bands, they held on to their records for so long. It's all what you could do. You're like, well, we'll just hold on to it a little longer. And after a while, you're like, it's been a year. We got to get it out.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then the records just disappear, which is a goddamn shame. So, you know, I shout these records out at all times, because there, you know, there was some magic made in 2021, you know?
Oh, absolutely. I hope that when we play live, it will remind people of that, though, and people go back to it because it's quite new for people to hear these songs played live, and it's still new for us to play them. It's still really exciting. It also is where how we play them live is always going to be a bit tougher and a bit rawer. So yeah, I just hope that when we do this tour in the States, you know, that people will go back and listen to that record and be reminded by it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It's got to be heard because it's a great record. Now, Josh Homme gets involved with this and you guys go record at his studio, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. That was very early on.
Does this happen from being on the road with Queens? Does he say, hey, I'll do your new record or something?
Yeah, not that, but we became real good pals with those guys and we're on the road for a long time with them. And Josh is a great friend and he was someone that we always, you know, thought of working with, and we love all the records that he's produced and been involved in. So we wanted to just get involved with him, and it was quite a natural, you know, thing to happen for us. And it was right at the start of the process of writing, and we had a few bits. We had, you know, Boilermaker was almost there and he helped us get that into place. And we had a couple more songs that are now B-sides on the record, but we kind of didn't know what to do, what direction we were going in. And he worked in his a brilliant way with us that was like, you guys can play, just play. And, you know, I'll just be here and listening, overseeing kind of thing. And it was just pressure off. And yeah, it was just a load of fun, really. We had a really good time doing that.
It's funny too, because you were on the tour where Josh and Queens, they took a total different turn with that record that you were on the tour with, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And some people can knock it and some people can love it or whatever, but I love a band that's like, nah, you're not going to, you know, lock me into a box.
Absolutely. With that record as well, I think it's brilliant because, again, hearing it live, it sounds different to the record, and you can really hear those songs and the songwriting that's gone into them, and it's brilliant. It's just absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, it's also brilliant just to, you know, not be doing the same record every time like a lot of bands do. There's only two bands I want to, or three really, Motorhead, Ramones, and AC/DC. And Slayer, those are the bands I want to do the same thing. But Queens is a lot like Metallica, where they're like, you know what? We're going to do a record with Lou Reed. You know what? We're going to do a record with no solos or whatever. And it's like, yeah. I don't care what you think. I've already made Ride the Lightning. Now go listen to that if that's what you need.
Absolutely. I mean, that was the same thing with us with Typhoons. People were, you know, we could easily make something that sounded like the first record, but we're like, that doesn't fulfill us as creatives. That, you know, we want to push ourselves to the limits here and explore other places and put strings and put things. You know, people go, you're a two-piece, that, you know, we're like, fuck that, we can do whatever we want. When you're in the studio, you do whatever you want to do.
Yeah, you ever heard of Bohemian Rhapsody?
Yeah, exactly. Sorry,
dummies.
Yeah.
I really like Typhoons too. It has kind of a flavor of some early Queens with some Muse and some 70s disco, which I love, you know. I love disco. I love the Bee Gees.
Yeah, man.
Man, I love that shit, you know, when it comes on. First of all, disco is some of the greatest songwriting ever because the hooks are massive, man.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And with that, like, everything's real on disco music. Everything's played in. All the drums that almost sound electronic now, everything is feel when it's groove and it's bringing everything together. And it's incredible.
It is. It is. I was just talking about it last week. Those are humans. Humans playing those instruments on that shit. Earth, Wind, and Fire, that is humans.
Yeah.
It's wild. People just they just take that for granted now. It's so good. And the landscape of the tracks is so great that no way would you think that's humans.
Exactly.
If you go YouTube Earth, Wind, and Fire and watch them play live, you're like, Whoa, man.
Yeah.
I love that shit. And I, you know, at the same time, I love Gary Numan. Like, Cars is just fantastic. That's like a techno-y kind of weird dance floor Studio 54 type of jam, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, man.
All that shit's great. Now, you guys had the honor of being on the Black Album, tracks. Metallica put out a box set, an anniversary of the Black Album. And then all these artists got to do their own interpretations of songs on the Black Album. You guys got one of the two best songs on there, me being Wherever I May Roam and Sad But True. Those are the two greatest tunes on that record. And Sad But True being one of the heaviest Metallica songs of all time. Did you guys get to pick the song? How does this work? Because I haven't had anybody on yet.
So they told us that they were doing it and said, you know, we're just getting loads of artists to just pick what song they want to do or whatever, and we'll just have loads of songs. If they get like 50 Enter Sandmans, and that's what they get. But I, as a Metallica fan myself, Mike was like, you lead the way with this. And so I picked the song and I wanted to go with something bold. I was like, we've got to do something bold. Like, and Sad But True almost picked us. It's like in our DNA, and just that riff driven rock. And I thought Mike killed it with the vocals as well, you know, because he hasn't got such a tough, like, rock voice like James has, but he's a lot softer. He's a bit more Josh, you know, on those kind of waves, a lot softer. But I thought he absolutely nailed it. And yeah, we kind of wanted to stay true to the song.
Yeah.
Because the recording is so brilliant of that record, and how the tempos change slightly. And so instead of playing that to a click, I actually played it listening to the song and just played along.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was the drum template done for that, was me just trying to copy Lars, which is a lot of fun. And then, yeah, then it was down to Mike. And it's just, again, it's a quite a task to play a Metallica song with just a bass guitar and a drum kit.
Oh, yeah.
Because we need to emulate two other guitars of one of the best metal bands in the world, the best metal band in the world, you know. So it's quite daunting, but I thought, you know, Mike absolutely killed it. And we made it a royal blood version, I guess, because we couldn't do his solo. We, like, there's no point in trying to copy that. But so we just did our own thing with it. And yeah, it was a lot of fun, and it was an honor to be involved on such a record.
Yeah, you guys did kick ass. And Mike, yeah, he does have that smooth thing, you know. His Sad But True, you know, it's like, it's this cool thing. That tune is, it just shows you how great that tune is, because a country guy could do it, an industrial band could do it, you know.
Absolutely.
A pop band could do it, and it'd all be great, you know.
Absolutely.
Now, when you record it, do you turn it in and then you wait? Do they just accept it no matter what, since you were selected?
Yeah, they kind of, it all happened so quick, and yeah, they just went with it.
Now, do you guys plan to play it live at all as a cover? That would be rad.
No, that would be rad, but we, I don't know if we can put it off. I think, you know, we have so many of our own songs that we can't play anyway. We might as well not be able to play a Metallica song.
Now by the way, Lars's son has a two-piece band.
Oh, yeah, no, they're rad, man. They're so good.
Yeah, I just opened for Metallica a couple months ago doing comedy, and it was their 40-year anniversary. So they had a whole week of parties and festivals in San Francisco, and I went and saw his son's band play, and they were fantastic, man.
Yeah, they're right.
Yeah, I mean, that guy, you know, Lars, his son plays bass, you know?
Yeah.
And his other son plays drums. But I was thinking, holy shit, if his son was a little older at the time when Cliff Burton was gone, of course that would be impossible, but he would easily been the bass player.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how good he is, you know?
Yeah, man. They rule.
Yeah, they do. Now, something really cool happened to you guys that just, I mean, had to just knock you out. But when you won the Brit Award, Jimmy, Jimmy Page gave you this fucking award. Jimmy Page, to me, is the best. There's no one ever, ever, ever will come close to him. What was that like? Did you get to talk to Jimmy, or did he hand the award to you and you cruise off?
We have a real funny relationship with Jimmy. He's, we always see him at award ceremonies, and it's because either we're presenting him an award or he's presenting us one. So we have this funny thing, but he's a fantastic guy. He's been to a lot of, he came to our first show in New York. He's a guy that when you see him, I don't know, there's a comfort in seeing Jimmy for me. You obviously think about him being this superstar, but he's so down to earth and so kind and so just gentle and easy to talk to. And especially for me as a drummer, I think Mike has more of a, more of a fanboy when it gets to that. But as a drummer, I'm a little bit more relaxed with him maybe. But he's brilliant. And the Brit Award thing is mad because it's obviously a show that I've grown up watching and seeing loads of bands win, and we were up against Coldplay and One Direction and all kinds of like mad artists. But and we were new on the scene. We had one record, and it was pretty crazy to win that.
That's fucking awesome, man, to beat all those guys out. And then Jimmy Page gives you the award. It's like,
I know.
You got to be going like, am I fucking even alive? Is this real?
It's a dream, isn't it? It's a dream.
Oh, my God. Did you get a photo with Jimmy?
I have a few, yeah. Jimmy, this is a bit of a story, but Jimmy once came to, we had a birthday meal with him, and he came along, and there's a picture of both me and Jimmy eating a birthday cake together.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, that's great. Dude, that's so fucking cool, man. Oh my God. Well, you got a new single out, Honey Brains.
Yeah, man.
Fucking great song, man. Great, great song. And you got a tour coming up. When does this tour start?
So it's been a little bit crazy because we've got a UK arena tour going on at the moment.
Whoa.
But which is insane. We just played the O2 Arena, sold out, which is like 20,000 people, which is sick. But it's been on its like highs and lows of this tour, because going back after like 2 years almost, isn't it, of not playing any tours. The first show back was incredible, and then our second one got cancelled in Paris because there was a protest going on, and they had shut all of our lorries with all of our stuff into a compound, and so we couldn't play that show. And then the latest one we played, we just come off stage at the O2, and Mike was struggling a little bit with his voice at the end, and he was like, I should take a test for COVID, and it turns out that he was positive.
God.
And so we had to reschedule. Well, at that time we had to cancel everything, and we've got such a great team, and they've managed to reschedule these dates. It's pretty hard to reschedule an arena tour with all the trucks and everything that goes into that, all the production. But we're hopefully getting back on the road, do another 3 dates from Sunday, and then the following Sunday we fly over to Toronto to start our US / Canada tour, and we're around for 6 weeks, I think, which we can't wait to do.
Wow. Now, where are you playing in LA?
We're doing quite a few in California, actually. I actually can't remember. But I think it might be something like that. And then we're playing in Anaheim and San Diego as well.
Yeah, I'm going to come see you, man.
Absolutely. Yeah, come on down.
That'd be great. Are you a big comedy fan? You like any stand-up comedy?
Absolutely. Yeah. Both me and Mike are big into it. So.
Oh, yeah. Who do you like?
I mean, we're big fans of Ricky Gervais.
Oh, yeah.
But we're into like Brass Eye and, I mean, Alan Partridge come over to you? Is that
I haven't seen him.
Okay, Steve Coogan plays his character called Alan Partridge. It's brilliant. But I'm a big American Office fan as well, so I love all of that.
How about Jimmy Carr? You like Jimmy Carr?
He's very good at comebacks, though, isn't he? What's it called?
Yeah, like crowd work. Yeah, crowd work. Yeah,
he's the best at that.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing you, and congrats on your success, man. Arena tour in Europe. That is just fantastic. Two piece.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Splitting the money two ways. How great is that?
If only that was the truth.
Yeah, I know. I get it. Yeah. But I'm looking forward to meeting you face to face, and stay healthy out there. And thanks for doing the show.
Absolutely. Thank you, man.
Yeah. And I love you guys' band, and I love your music, and anybody that's had birthday cake with Jimmy Page is fucking top shelf right there.
Brilliant. Thank you.
I'll see you soon, man.
See you soon. Nice one.
Thank you, brother.
Bye.
See ya.